first of all, I'd just like to say congratulations on the film. I really enjoyed it. It's certainly a family drama with a difference. For listeners, could you give a short synopsis of the film, obviously without giving too much away?
Sure. A Lion Returns is about the story of Jamal, who'd disappeared before the film even starts. And we start the film with his return from Syria, where he'd been being involved in some nefarious activities with militants over there. So he's back in the country. He wants to see his mother, who's not well. She hasn't got long to live. But before he gets to see his mother, he needs to get through his brother, his relationship with his brother. It's very important, this one. It's pretty intense. And then eventually the brother realizes that he's not well. He, in fact, he's even probably suffering from PTSD. And since he's back, as a last kind of wish for his mother, maybe you want to put, you know, reunite the mother and the son together. Once people find out that he's back and start spotting him, we've got a few surprise elements coming through, and, you know, people have to deal with his return and what he did to them.
Sure. Now, I just want to ask you about the title of the film, A Lion Returns. To my Western eyes, it seems like a slightly provocative title. Why did you choose that?
Well, before I answer that, why would you think it's provocative?
Well, describing Jamal as a lion when the things he's gone to Syria to do, and you describe them as slightly nefarious. I wouldn't describe someone as a lion who went and did those sort of things.
I think because of his stray from the lion herd and because he's left the herd, lost his way, he's come back into the lion's herd and he's back with the family. So that was in some way that the idea of that title, the fact that we've lost a lion cub and now he's made his way back into the herd.
I guess when you first saw and read media reports of young men and women returning from the Islamic State or from Syria and what have you, or trying to return, what was your perspective on these people?
I mean, obviously, if you want to go back a little bit and go back to the causes and what really triggers all these kind of overseas travels, I think because we're dealing with the destabilizing of the Middle East, the wars in the Middle East, the bombings and invasions and whatnot. So it kind of goes right back, in fact, to the Iraq War. So between 2003 and 2009, there are a lot of these foreigners, let's call them, heading into Iraq to fight Westerns, the invaders, the occupiers, the imperialists, right? So somehow between 2009 and 2011, that switched around. That went from going over there and killing infidels to going over there and creating a caliphate. And creating a caliphate would mean cleansing or removing or killing or whatever of any non-believers, kafirs, they call them, like the Muslims that really believe the proper way. And their idea of creating that caliphate is one of the reasons why a lot of them went over there. Mm-hmm. Now, if you actually think about it, if you see images of these terrorists, whether it doesn't matter if it's the ISIS, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, whatever, they're in these big white pickup trucks, black flags going through barren lands from town to town. And I was wondering where all the drone strikes. How come these people are allowed to just roam through and take over cities and towns when you know that whole area, Pakistan, India, Syria, all that area, Afghanistan, the whole area is monitored by so many drones. How come these guys are allowed to go over there and do what they did? Then you kind of work out from, I mean, the evidence is out now. You understand Americans and the British that were supporting a lot of these Free Syrian Army fighters, right? So the people over here, the Australian Arabs, and they're not all Muslims that went over, by the way. There's a lot of converts as well. They're thinking, this is a good cause. This is like a crusade. We're going to go over there. We're going to fight like soldiers. We're going to create our own caliphate, our promised land, and great. But did they not think, was it a bit of a spider's trap? Like, you're all going to go over there. So everyone knows you're there. So if they ever want to get rid of all the terrorists, they're just going to bomb your caliphate. They didn't think that far ahead. And I thought that was very sad. I thought, how could they not think that far ahead that somehow they were going to be allowed to have their own Muslim territory and what, on other people's land? And to create that land, obviously they've got to get rid of people who don't affiliate or don't think the same way as them. Basically, to install Sharia law, you've got to come down with a hard whip. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they did. From 2011, when they got into Raqqa, Aleppo, Idlib and all that, they did create their own caliphate. And there's a Vice documentary. I don't know how Vice got in there, by the way, without getting their heads chopped off. They were following them around Aleppo, where they were executing the law and creating their own caliphate. And it's like, how is this happening? So as you see these images, this is kind of a bit of a recruitment poster for other young fighters who want to go over there. Now, when you look at specific Australians, yes, some of them were driven by ideology. Some of them were driven by land. Like, they're great, we're going to have our own land, we're going to have our own, you know, way of life and so on. And then also money, A lot of them were getting paid to go over. They were getting paid monthly fees. And some of them, Khalid Sharouf and a few other ones, they were all had a nefarious background here. They all had criminal backgrounds. So you knew install religion into that mix and then tell them to go over there and do that. It's a lethal cocktail. And you see the images. There's a Four Corners documentary called Gangster Jihadi. And it talks about, you know, between 2013 and 14 and about 2015-16, Australia's kind of involvement in that whole migrating to that part of the Middle East. And then after that, some of them were coming back.
So you don't think it's fair to tar them all with the same brush then?
It depends where they went, because some went to Iraq, some went to join certain groups. There's a lot of groups over there, and there were a lot of them broke off and started their own. So the core reasons were the Free Syrian Army. And what is that? Who is that? Still to this day, it's not really evident. We do know that a lot of terrorists got involved in those mix, and they were over there really just killing other Arabs and Muslims and farmers and whatnot. If they didn't believe and they didn't fall in line with them, they were just eliminated. So that's the sad part about it. But the Australians that went over there, yeah, a lot of them went over there. Over 100 went over. I think 70 were killed in action. That's verified. There's about 30-odd that come back. How they came back? In my research, I found out that some of them would say they went over for humanitarian reasons, i.e. I went to Turkey. From Turkey, I made my way. Once you get to Turkey, once you leave the Turkish territory, you're off the grid, really. So it's very hard for the Australian government to prove, once they landed in Turkey, where'd you go? Because their passports weren't stamped once they entered Syria, however they got in. And then there's about 20 or 30 that are unaccounted for. They don't know if they're back, they don't know if they're missing in action, they don't know if they've died, they don't know if they've gone to another country. So that's kind of the whole kind of backstory of character.
So, I mean, did your perspective on these people change as you did more research as you were preparing the film?
A little bit, yeah. It was really sad to see some of them had families, loved ones. Like I think I mentioned in one of my other articles and interviews that one of them was holding his own daughter, one-year-old daughter in his arms, who was born while he was gone, and he's back and the Australian police knew about him. And he's being interviewed and he's saying something like, if they gave me my passport back, I'll head back over. Like, do you not consider the possibility of you not coming back and you've got a child and a wifey? Mm. And some of them, as you know, their families followed them over there. Their wives and their kids followed them over there and they stayed over there. Some of them are still stuck over there. They can't go back in.
As part of your research, were you able to speak to any families who are currently going through this situation with loved ones returning or wanting to return?
Not wanting to return. I did speak to a father whose son went over there and didn't come back. He was distraught. His silences were enough for me to tell me that he was uncomfortable talking about it because he was either ashamed or really hurt. And that kind of became this sort of model for the father's character, silence and sort of not really expressing too much. And he was really sad, yeah. He just thought that his son was brainwashed or tricked into going over for whatever reason. And some of them, like, you know, some of them aren't well. Some of them were lost. They've had underlying mental health issues. They were grabbing on to ideologies and movements and religion or whatever it was that made them feel like, hey, look, this is my purpose now. I need to do something. I'm just not being accepted or I'm not feeling good about myself. So that was, again, that was the kind of a model for my lead character as well, the fact that he wasn't well. And then when he was 15, 16, religion did help him get out of that dark place. But then as we know for mental illness and depression, it comes back. If it's not diagnosed, treated properly, the recovery is not as easy as you seem. It's not just a mental thing. It's actually physiological. It's in your body. It makes you feel sad. So when he was 21, that darkness came back again. And this time his uncle said to him, like, hey, look, best thing you can probably do now is you're not happy here. You're not happy. Go do something worthwhile. Go over there and join your brothers and sisters over there and do something. Not really directly intending him to go and join ISIS. This is the thing that people are making a mistake of. His uncle didn't groom him to actually send him over to the fight with ISIS. His uncle really just said to him, go over to Syria. I've got some friends over there to look after you. Go into the mountains, do some training, join some movements. But whether it was going to be ISIS or Al-Qaeda, that's sort of not clear.
All right. Well, I kind of got the impression that that's why he did what did send him over to get involved with as the film went on. He, slightly dodgy fellow.
Yeah.
The uncle.
He's a bit like an Iago in Othello, isn't he?
Just getting back to, so was that father that you spoke with, was he the only person that you were able to
I did speak to also a girlfriend of a young Lebanese boy who went over. He came back. I couldn't get to him, but his girlfriend, I remember talking to his girlfriend and she was like, he wants me to go over. I don't want to go over. You know, I've got my parents here. I've got, you know, my family, my job. And she was in two minds. She was going to convert for him, but didn't because he left. He left her. Mm-hmm. So she didn't go through it. She thought he was just going over for holidays with his mates. And then he sort of like went off the grid for a while. Then, and then he's come back. Apparently he's back.
Okay. Now, was it difficult to make this film and not fall on one side or other of the argument?
I mean, I remember during writing and development, we really wanted to get his perspective. We really wanted to get an idea of, hey, look, you just can't go, he's bad, he went over there, he thinks he did something good. No, that still wasn't good enough. The reasons why he went over there are clearly outlined by the character himself. And in his mind, at the time, he thought he's doing the right thing. No one knew it was going to end the way it ended. No one knew that the caliphate was going to get destroyed by the Russians and the Syrians and the Americans eventually. No one knew that when they went over there, they were going to be raping or chopping people's heads off. No one told him this. No one, everyone just bloated them up. Said, you're going to be like Mujahideen over there. Go over there and fight and do whatever you want to do. It's going to be great. And it was, like I said, between 2011 and 2013, it was exactly what they planned. But then people are resistant towards invaders in their own country. So eventually the people started fighting back and caliphate's kind of basically left to one corner of Syria, and that's Idlib, where they're still trying to regroup there, would you believe?
What's been the reaction from Muslims who've seen the film so far?
We haven't reached out that far yet. So when the film gets released on November the 5th, I think that's probably the best indication that we'll see what the audience that this film kind of shines a light on will be. But from the people who have come to the test screenings that we've had and also the premiere a couple of weeks ago, most of them understand that these actions do not bring a good name to their religion and their culture and their identity. They do know that. Like what most Arab Muslims do not agree to creating or going through with a mission in these ways. They recognise that. And obviously when it comes to the family and love and mother and father and son and all that stuff, obviously they can see having a son like a black sheep or doing what he does doesn't reflect good upon the family either. So they recognise that. And like I said, I wanted to make sure that the film wasn't really about a flag-waving, symbolic, patriotic version of an ISIS guy coming back and being so proud and telling everyone to get stuffed, whatever you want. It wasn't about that. It was really him understanding that he's gone over, he's come back and he's not well and he's been affected by what's happened. So redemption, family, love, PTSD, choices, all that kind of would come into it more than, hey, his actions over there. There was a couple of times when during that first 30 minutes, if I had money, I may have shot some scenes that looked like it was in Syria and whatnot. But I just thought, you know what, I don't want to glorify what he did. I don't want to show any of that. It's not about that. It's not about him going over there and going, look what I did. Him saying it and underneath why he's saying it, he's still hanging on for things that he's been passed on to him over there. Like a lot of the stuff he talks about, you know, media and Middle East and all that stuff and demonising Arabs and so on. Obviously, he would have picked that up from talking to other people over there and being groomed and whatnot. So he's just spouting stuff that's already been taught and the brother's really over it. The brother knows this is just, he can tell it's not really him inside.
Let's move on to talking about the film. You've already mentioned that the opening scene, which is quite long, the film does contain a couple of reasonably long scenes, especially the one in the car at the beginning. Now, that's fairly unusual in modern filmmaking. Why did you choose to make such a long scene, particularly at the beginning?
Originally, the car scene was going to be a one-act play. Two actors on stage, sitting on a back seat on stage, and you know, every now and then they'll walk away from the seat and talk to their wives and whatnot and their partners, and then come back to the seat. And when I started writing it, I realised that this should be the beginning of a screenplay. So that first 30 minutes has its own three-act structure. The first act really deals with Jamal's return, what he's done, the shame he's brought and his mission and all that stuff. The middle act is really about politics, Middle East, the culture, the community's reaction, the brothers, the intensity of when they were children, what happened to him and the terrorism and the labelling they got after September 11 and whatnot. And the third act really deals with what actually happened to him over there, what was going on before he left, what he's learned from it, and also his vulnerability at the moment. He's not in a good place. And that's the trigger that really lets his older brother go, okay, look, let me just go inside and talk to some people. I'll see what I can do. And so that three-act structure, I thought if I can maintain the audience's attention to follow these characters in that situation, in the car with them, it can build up enough tension. That tension in there can be sort of like a leading up to what happens in the house and so on. I was very inspired by Eli Kazan's On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger in the back seat, and also a Turkish film called Winter Sleep. There was a 30-minute scene between the lead character and his sister. He's at the typewriter. She's sitting on the couch and having this argument and talking, and it's like, you don't even realise 30 minutes went by. It was so beautifully shot, so beautifully directed. And also another film called Day and Night, a Danish film where a guy sitting in a car it's his last day because he's going to kill himself. The whole film is set inside his car, and he goes and drops off his daughter. Then he goes and sees his mistress. Then he goes to his work and calls his wife and so on. So that was all set in the car as well. I thought, if I can combine those three elements and make sure the acting works in that first 30 minutes, the acting is of high quality. It's not over the top or larger than life or not overexpressed. I'll be able to maintain it.
Can I just ask about the acting? Most actors aren't used to acting a 30-minute scene on film either. I mean, how do you go about directing that?
Rehearsal's good when you rehearse. And also when you shoot, you don't shoot the whole 30 minutes in one. We tried to, but there were so many interruptions like planes and sweat beads and the camera would fan would cut on and there was dialogue fluff-ups. So what you do is we would rehearse weeks before the whole 30 minutes, then talk about it and then break it up into little sections and say, look, this area is not working. So rehearsal was prominent and paramount to what happened. Once we started shooting, I think maintaining that intensity, we've cut enough coverage, enough takes. So in the editing room, I had enough material to put it together. So I kept the intensity and the emotional levels at the right levels all the way through. So it never lagged in some places. And that's probably the beauty of rehearsing, acting, and editing together. Those three combined to give you a 30-minute that, you know, hopefully you don't lose that much interest. But although I must say, seeing it in a cinema is completely different to seeing it on a laptop, iTop, or desktop. We know this because for the last year, as the film has been finishing at rough stages and in working progresses, we've had test screenings. We've sent the film off to people. And every single time we sent the film, whether it was for post-production funding or whether it was for a festival, we've had negative zero responses, right? Nothing, nothing. However, every time we've done a cinema screening, including at the 37 South Film Market, we had a kind of a fine rough cut on my birthday a couple of years ago. And then we've had one at Afters at the film school, test screening. Every single one of those screenings, people were talking about it. They needed a moment to themselves. They stayed back for the Q&A. So it has a different visceral effect in a cinema for some reason. I think it's maybe because the characters are so large, you're not being interrupted. They're not isolated. It doesn't look like a little TV screen. When they're in a cinema screen, the characters, they're like gods on there. And you really follow what's going on. You really get affected by what they're talking about without the distractions of phones and people interrupting you. So it has a different effect.
Just asking about, you know, the two brothers, Jamal and Omar, how can they be so different in their outlook when they come from the same family?
Look, if you've got siblings, anyone who's got siblings will understand this. Like one turns out like the black sheep, the other one's as an angel.
Well, I have a sister, but like she and I, we used to be quite far apart in our views. We've actually, or
as you got older,
as we've gotten older, we've actually come back towards the thinking.
I've got two older sisters. So one of my older sisters, throughout my 20s, I didn't get along with her at all. But now, like she's had my niece and my nephew and myself, and so we're really, really close now. I think because I lost my mother to cancer, my father's overseas, he's in Turkey. So we're really close now. But I know from just experience when I was doing research for Cedar Boys, I knew realized that even for my own friends, when there's brothers and there's two or three of them, there's always one of them that either has something to do with the father or they're rebellious. This is when you start moving into, is it nature to nurture idea? Is it the environment they grew up in, the attention they didn't get, or is it chemicals or something about them? So there is differences. There's no doubt about it. There's been studies done. You know, even twins. Like we've got another film about Catherine Knight, who's the woman that in the year 2000 stabbed her husband 37 times, skinned him and took his head off, right, put in a pot. Yep, true story. Now, she was a twin, and her twin turned out fine. No problem at all. But Catherine, she had personality disorders. She had anger management issues. She really wanted attention. She worked in the abattoir. She was good with knives. So she turned out completely the opposite. So I suppose the question is, if you're a parent and you've got a child like this, how do you deal with it? Do you disband them? Do you push them aside? Do you still love them? I remember watching a documentary about the Columbine massacre from 1999, 98, and they were interviewing one of the mothers of the two guys, and she said, how can I not love him? He's my son. How do you deal with it? And this is the whole thing about having a son that's a jihadi. In fact, there is a documentary called, in England, it's called My Brother the Jihadi or How to Hug a Jihadi or something, and it's a white woman talking about her converted son who went to fight for ISIS in North Africa. He never came back. There's actually one little grainy footage of him fighting, and that's it. And she's saying, like, he's my son. I can't see him doing this. I don't know how this happened. I wish he'd come back to me. I love him. I know somewhere when I look up, he's looking at the same moon as I'm looking at. Do you know what I mean? So that maternal instinct, love, nurturing, I don't think that would go away. I know that in our story, the mother definitely doesn't agree with what he does. The amount of times he says, you know, I was doing something honourable, she goes, that's not honourable, my son. That's not honourable. Doing what you did is not honourable. Whoever told you that? And she quotes something out of the Quran to him. She says, you know, you will be judged like this based on what you've done. And it starts sinking in. And you sort of, I don't know if you realise, but sort of in the story somewhere, there might be a reason why he's actually back as well, another reason.
Oh, yes. I don't want to give it away.
No, I think because of what happens with the brother in the car and then his wife and then the uncle and then his mother, I think these were all steps that he was looking for. And all he wanted was that last step from the father to change his mind, maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Which I was going to ask you about. His mother, his brother, and even his wife, they seem ready to embrace Jamal. Yeah. But what's holding Dad back?
Oh, my God, it's a good question, isn't it? For some reason, I can only draw reference to my father. I went through a bit of a rebellious period in my late teens, early 20s, and my dad didn't want nothing to do with me. Like, I'd come over and he'd walk out of the room, go to the backyard and have a cigarette. I think our fathers have expectations, and I think this goes back to then Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman and his son Biff, how the son sort of sees the father doing something very young, in flashbacks, of course, and then from that day forth, he never has any respect for his father, so he goes off the rails and loses himself and he's not stable, ends up in jail. So the father's still hanging on to this thing where the son's just let me be who I want to be and just love me. So because the father takes some sort of responsibility, so what he does is to deal with it, he casts the son aside. He does not nothing to do with him.
So do you think it's because the father thinks that he's failed somehow?
Close, yes. Something like that, yeah.
You can't reconcile that.
That's exactly right, yeah. Okay. Even though the older brother tries to get him to look, he just wants to talk to you for 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes, Dad. No. I mean, you know what happens at the end, to that point. Yeah. Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
do you have a favourite scene in the film?
No one's asked me that, actually. I do like the first 8 minutes a lot. No. It's like asking you who's your favourite child.
I'm just interested because once it's out there, then you go back and look at it, and I just thought you might go, oh, wow, that's actually turned out a lot better than I thought it was going to go.
Well, because it's filmmaking such a process, Michael. Yeah. You see all these I know every single frame in that film, so you kind of – I've seen probably the film about 160 times, and I must admit, I still enjoy watching the whole film. And, yes, I wrote it. Yes, I directed it. It's still like – I don't have a favourite scene. I do like – I enjoy watching it with an audience. I really do. There's a different kind of vibe and energy in the room when you're watching it with people. You can feel the tension moments when there's nobody moving in the cinema. You understand it's working. Mm-hmm. No one's even flinching, you know what I mean? Then they get let off, you know what I mean? So I don't have a favourite scene. I really don't.
Now, you shot a 90-page script in 10 days. What was the rush?
It was more the money. It wasn't the rush. It was – that's all we can afford at the time. At the time – we crowdfunded the shooting budget, most of the shooting budget, and then we had a couple of investors. One gave us $15,000, the other one gave us $10,000. So that $15,000 in our crowdfunding money, that was part of our shooting budget, and that's all we could afford at the time was 10 days. Ideally, this would have been a four-week, 20-day shoot, like 5-5-5. That wasn't to be, so I had to make some sacrifices during the shoot, certain cameras and certain equipment. We basically treated it like a documentary shoot, very minimum lighting. Two cameras going at the same time because there was so much dialogue. So covering with two cameras is really good for continuity and for the acting. We just planned, rehearsed. There was a couple of unexpected situations that popped up. Like they had my headphone comms to a cable to the camera, to the sound person. It wasn't wireless. So on the first day, I said, can someone, here's my credit card, go get me a wireless headset because I need to be at the monitors, not next to them because I can't reach out, you know what I mean? One of the cameras, like I said, the fan kept coming on, so ideally it would have been good to shoot this in winter inside a car. Would have been perfect. Just collaboration, planning, focus. The first AD was told to take all the phones off the actors so they don't get distracted because they love their social media, you know.
Except Uncle Yaya.
Yes, yeah.
He needed his phone.
Yeah. So, yeah, just planning and a good crew. They were a great crew.
Just getting to the end of the film, again, without wanting to give it away, were you always planning for the film to end like that? Because I really want to know what happens next.
Yeah. The script was slightly different. The script had an end result, right? But I just thought to end it that way would be a little bit of a cop-out, a little bit. So I tried to leave it a bit more open-ended. Then there was another idea of just tweaking, and this happened in editing. So in the script, we had one kind of ending, which I'll release the screenplay once the film is released because people have been asking for it. And then during editing, I had another version where you don't see it. You know what I mean? So you don't see it. How else could it have ended if you think about it? There was no really alternative, especially that last image of, and you know, his kid and so on. So Most of my short films and my previous feature, if you don't have a powerful ending, you don't leave the audience with something to think about. If it's an ending that doesn't pay off everything that's happened to the point where, now I know what you're trying to say. If I'm these characters, is that where I end up? The headspace I end up in. So the themes and ideas and the messages really need to be carried through right to the end. And if they're not expressed or advocated towards the audience, the message of the film cannot come through unless you have a powerful ending enough to say, wow, okay, I didn't expect that, or what would I have done? Do you know what I mean?
Now, I've just got a bit of a nitpick question here.
Go.
I did watch this film with a Muslim friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a scene where Uncle Yahya tells the father, Yusuf, to pray to the Prophet.
Mm.
Now, my friend thought this was a bit odd, as Muslims only pray to God. I'm just wondering why he might have said that.
The Prophet Muhammad?
Yeah.
It's a good question, actually. To tell you the truth, that line, you ready for this? It wasn't in the script. So that actor, Buddy Danone, who was in Cedar Boys as well, Buddy's known to tweak lines around. And I'll let you on a little secret. Those shots of him, the back of his head on the phone, the first one, I had to stay on the back of his head. Creative, it's great. It makes him more mysterious, right? Because Buddy changed all his lines in Arabic on the day when we were shooting. And on that Saturday when I was shooting, I had to shoot 17 scenes when we were losing light. And I didn't get a chance to get someone next to me and go, just didn't even think about having one of the other Arabic actors next to me, Lebanese actors, hearing what he's saying. So I just thought he's on script and he was just saying what I wrote. But then when I got into the editing room and I got somebody to come in just so I can be accurate, the other actor said to me, sir, he's not saying that. So what do you mean? He goes, he's saying blah, blah, blah. I said, are you serious? He went, yeah. I said, Buddy, get to the studio now because we have to redo all your dialogue because you went off script. And then with the father again, when I was translating, and the actor said to me, he's not saying that either. I said, what is he saying? He's saying, peace be upon you and pray to the Prophet. It's going to all work out. Don't worry. And went, and I couldn't change that because he's on camera on that one. But at least on the phone, I had the back of his head so I can sort of put in the dialogue after.